Moncrief on News Talk.
Sponsored by Avantcard. With personalised pricing, our rates are made for you.
Yes, Joanna Fortune's joining us, our resident parenting expert, to go through some of your questions sent in for the parenting slot. And as ever, if you have a question, email it to afternoon@newstalk.ie or you can text it to 53106. Joanna, how are you?
Good, Sam. How are you?
Are you all ready for Halloween?
Absolutely ready. Yeah, as in I've done nothing at all for Halloween.
Nor have I.
So
people are saying
ready.
I'm giving them stress that I haven't even begun to think of
not
an outfit.
Not a thing.
Which I'll be wearing in less than 3 hours time.
I know, but isn't that it? Do you remember, like, when we were kids ourselves, I sound like, oh, in good old days. I don't mean like that, but black plastic bags and any random mask that your parents happened to pick up, that was your costume.
Yeah,
that's
and
what
you
were.
You couldn't breathe through it. It's
They've
those
gone
plastic
fierce
things.
Fancy now.
Sweat on your
yeah,
face.
Yeah, exactly. So pleasant. But costumes have gotten so complicated.
In your professional capacity, is there advice you'd like to offer parents this evening?
Yeah.
Ages they should be taking them out at, ages they mightn't bring them out at, that kind of stuff?
I think, you know, this is going, it's very difficult for me to say at this age and this age because children are different, you know, and you'll know your own children's capacity. Obviously, the little ones, the preschoolers, even, you know, kind of senior infants, first class and under, they'll probably be, do better and cope better being brought around earlier in daylight. There's more control. They're not coming into contact with older kids and any of the kind of rough and tumble mayhem going on, and it's not that dark out. So I think that can be really helpful for them. And obviously, the younger the child, the more supervision they need. And I think it's a good opportunity, though, to practice some independence, because you can have your child. I was, you know, intrigued at some of those texts that kids don't sing on the doors anymore. You could have your child go to the door themselves, knock and interact with somebody while you stand a safe distance at the gate, so that you're not helicoptering or hovering over them, but you're empowering them to do something on their own and interact and have that brief exchange, yep, and then return to you. So you're there, but you're giving them the opportunity to practice independence. I think that could be lovely. And I'd really see if you've a child who's 5 years old or older, they should be having that opportunity.
They love it.
I'd say, Tom, like, honestly, people listening and the people that I hear from at this time of year, they're asking me less questions about the little ones and more questions about the older ones at this time. That the little ones, and when they will let you go out with them and go trick-or-treating with them, that seems to be a lot of fun and the magical part of Halloween. The mischief, as somebody, one of your texters mentioned there, that bit tends to kick in the adolescent years when, of course, you're not going to be going and standing at gates and supervising them. So I think it's a time of year that causes worry for parents. The older the child is rather than the younger they are.
It's funny, as you say, are they able to perform anything when they get to the doors? As I think about it now, a lot of them actually aren't. And my two, when challenged last year, every one of two parents, all they did was sing that silly ABC song, which has to be
whatever they default
to. It's the only thing they can think of.
I think just be sensitive to that, because you don't know these, like you were saying, you know, children are strange. These are strangers interacting, but you don't know these children either. And simply standing on your door and ringing your doorbell may be a lot for some of these kids to do. I think it's perfectly okay and even nice to invite a song. But if it's not forthcoming, I wouldn't insist or demand or withhold sweets because of it. I think invite it. But if the child chooses not to, just accept that and move on.
There was one person last year, before I ask your first question, which was completely brilliant. They went up to a door and there was a little, looked like a model of a boy standing there.
Oh,
and
right.
They rang the bell. He said, boo, he was a live child pretending to be scared the life out of them. It was brilliant. They're still talking about it.
Some people are so creative around it and really embrace everything that's going with it. And other people are like, not for me, not bothered at all. One of my neighbours did tell me that if you don't decorate your house around our way, nobody will call. That's the cue. We welcome you or we don't.
Okay.
As if you've got some decorations up, come on and knock on the door. And if you don't,
you're making a statement.
Exactly.
All right, stay away from me. 5306 for your text or email afternoon@newstalk.com. Our first question today is this. My 18-year-old son decided he didn't want to go back to college after doing a year. He didn't have any friends in the college, and unfortunately, due to shyness or social anxiety, he didn't make any either. He got a job last June and has been working full-time ever since, and hopefully this will give him time to decide what's next. He enjoyed the summer going out a bit with a small group of friends. The problem is they're all back at local college and his social life has come to a grinding halt. They're always busy or he's working. It's really getting him down and his shyness slash social anxiety is making it worse. Any advice?
I think what a caring parent, you know, to write in and is clearly concerned about this 18-year-old. I think it's great that he got a job, by the way, and he's managing to hold that down and do well in it. And there's a couple of things in this letter that jump out at me. I think it's highlighting how we make an assumption that transitioning from secondary school to college or university, whatever it is going to be seamless and it's fantastic and embrace it and run with it. It's such a huge transition because, you know, you may have made that transition from primary to secondary, which is, you know, the biggest in the small school to the smallest in the big school, and you negotiate your way up. But when you make that transition from the structure and, you know, controlled parameters of secondary school, which can feel stifling to some, but ultimately structured, safe and predictable to others, college is the complete opposite. No one's checking if you go in or not. It's a completely more fluid environment. And I don't think it's easy for everyone. So I think this experience is quite common. The one thing I just want to pick up on, though, is the interchangeable use of shyness and social anxiety. Those are different things. So I'm not saying this boy, young man, does not have social anxiety, but I don't want it to be interchangeable with shyness. I mean, you can have somebody who has social anxiety and is also shy.
Okay.
But you may also have someone who's shy without being socially anxious or socially anxious without being shy, if I'm making sense there.
No, yeah.
Shyness is a personality trait. Social anxiety is that you experience overwhelming feelings when you're in social situations that actually impede upon your ability to interact and engage. Now, he may have some traits of that, but he is managing to hold down a job, by all accounts, quite well. So I would be veering on the shyness. Now, that being said, and while it's great he has a job, I'm hearing the concerns that the peer interactions, which are so important at this stage of anyone's life, are limited. I'm going to ask the question if he's into any kind of sports, because joining a sports team can at least be one or two nights a week that you are engaged with others with shared interest. It can also be that there can be quite a social component to sports activities at this age. And it doesn't have to be sports, but some kind of a club, I think, could be really useful. If this is really social anxiety, then I'm going to have to suggest talking to somebody.
Okay.
Particularly, we would recommend cognitive behavioral therapy around social anxiety because it can be very helpful in giving coping strategies and techniques to manage the anxiety that arises and can set attainable challenges to strive for and achieve. So I think that could be really good as well. So I think it's about sitting down and talking to him and seeing, what does he want to change? How, and then work backwards and say, okay, this is what you want. How do we get you there? But I think start small and build up.
Okay. But you're distinguishing very much so between shyness and social anxiety.
They're very different things.
Next one for you, 10-year-old perfectionist. I have a 10-year-old girl. She gets very upset and frustrated if she can't do something to a very high level. I think she might be a bit of a perfectionist and I can see this making life tough on her. She's quite shy and thinks carefully about her actions and decisions. An example would be the other day a few visitors were in and they asked, would she play a tune on the fiddle? She's been practicing a lot and was happy with her progress. Even though she was shy about it, she seemed to want to do it at the same time. But the minute a mistake was made, she stopped, got really upset and refused to keep going. Of course, everyone encouraged her to try again, which drew attention and only made things worse. She can be like this about homework and games, etc. But I'm afraid it will hold her back in life if she is afraid of failure. How do I help her see that to make mistakes is okay and everything doesn't have to be perfect all the time? Enjoying things is more important. This is the trait I also have and it has affected my confidence over the years. It can hold you back from attempting to do things when you were afraid of getting it wrong. It's a self-esteem issue, perhaps. Have you any tips or books or advice to help her overcome this? This would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, a concerned mum.
I mean, I think there's so much here and I think what you're seeing in your daughter is clearly triggering old feelings in yourself as well. And just be careful that you can differentiate and own what's coming from you and what you're observing in her and that you don't inadvertently project onto her your own issues around perfectionism. Because I actually think you've got quite a good insight here because it's something you've experienced yourself. And a starting point may be at 10 years old to sit down and talk to her about it and say, I've been thinking about and use the recent example, what happened when we had visitors and, you know, when you made that mistake, how it made you feel. And, you know, when I was your age, I had feelings like this and it really caused me difficulties. And, you know, have a conversation with her. At 10, she's going to be able to do that. I also want to go back to that example about the playing the fiddle for visitors. That's quite a lot for a child to take on. You know, you're performing for a group of people and you want to do well and then it doesn't go well and everyone's looking at you and it can be very intense and uncomfortable and stir up some kind of shame-based feelings, you know, embarrassment and discomfort. So I think that reflect afterwards how she would like this to have gone would be my tip. So in the moment, just kind of say, oh, I think that's enough music for now and everyone move on. The visitors will certainly take your cue and your lead on that, I imagine. But afterwards, sit with her and reflect, okay, so how do you wish that had gone? What would you do differently if we were doing it again? And always give her an out. Like if someone says, oh, play your fiddle for us and they're well-meaning, you could say, would you like to do this? And if the child says, no, not really, just say, well, you know, that's okay. Because
this
I think
it's the job.
Exactly. And don't force it. I think it's great to always, in general, no matter if you have a child who's a perfectionist or not, but to focus on praising effort over outcome and be specific in your praise. You know, I really thought it was great when you focus so hard to get this, or you really concentrated on what colours you wanted to pick for your picture, instead of saying, you Picasso, look at this beautiful work of art you've produced. You know, we want to let them know that it's okay if it's not beautiful as well as it being. But I think with this parent, again, you want to focus, you're saying that, you know, how to help her see that making mistakes is okay. The best way to do with that with children is actually to model it. Talk about making mistakes yourself in a positive way. So you talk about, you know, oh, I was trying this and it didn't work, or this happened, or I made a mistake. But you know what was really helpful was in making that mistake, I worked out how to do it next time. And now I know. So how we talk about making mistakes is the best way to teach our children to embrace the learning they can draw from mistakes. And involve her in setting realistic goals for herself before you go to something, be it something like homework. Sit down and say, okay, what do you want to get from this today? Or you're preparing for a spelling test, how will you know you've done well? You know, are we looking for a 7 out of 10 plus, or does it have to be a 10? Help her set realistic goals for herself.
I'd be great at showing her how to make mistakes. I'd give her lots of experiences.
But you know, Tom,
because I make so many of them.
But I think we all do. But as parents, we're often afraid to show that we've made a mistake because we feel like we're supposed to be these all-knowing entities for our children and we're flawless and we never get it wrong and that we're strong when we're right. Actually, it's a really good parenting tool to say, I got that wrong. And not to be afraid, even if it's something that you've done in or around your child, to go and apologize and say, I didn't get that right this time. I'm really sorry about that. Next time I'm going to do it better. I think that what I did wasn't good for you.
So am I admitting that I can't parallel park has been some good parenting for my children? That's good news. I'm going to ask you the question, what is an appropriate time for a 16-year-old to be out on a Halloween night in a moment? But we're going to have this break and come back with that. You're very welcome back. Tom Dunn sitting in for Sean today and Joanna Fortune is with us answering your parenting questions. I was just saying to you before the break, one of our listeners wanted to know, what's an appropriate time for a 16-year-old to be out until on Halloween night, an anxious parent?
Yeah, I hear the anxiety there with good reason, but it's such a subjective question because no two 16-year-olds are going to be the same. So for me, bigger than what time should they be in at, the bigger question is, where are they at? So if you are saying my 16-year-old is going to be out at a friend's house where the friend's parents are there at home, then of course you could extend the curfew because they're maybe having some kind of Halloween party together in the house and you're going to pick them up or the friend's parents is or whatever. But if your 16-year-old is simply out in that kind of ambiguous out.
In the out-out.
In the out-out, exactly. And you're not quite sure, but vaguely think they're in and around a certain area, then yeah, you probably want to put a curfew down to be sure that they're home. And I don't know, I could throw out an arbitrary number now, like maybe 11 o'clock. But of course, I have to own that that's my own subjective thing, that if it was my 16-year-old, I'd want them in at 11. But that doesn't mean that's the right time. So I think go with your parental instinct on this. But more important than what time they come home is where are they at?
Okay, big reaction to perfectionist kids. And one listener saying, thank you, Joanna, from a mummy of two kids at autism. We go dark for Halloween as the constant ringing bell and strangers at the door make the kids too anxious. Plus, some of the kids at your door could be non-speaking kids at autism.
So that's exactly what I was thinking.
Don't make them sing, Lisa Marie.
And some anxious little children, you know, parents do a huge big job leading up to this simply to get them to come up and knock on your door. And that's been such a social goal for this family. Yeah. So don't push it too much with the singing.
As a fiddle teacher, you always tell your students that if they make one little mistake to keep going so as not to let one little wrong note spoil all the other good notes. kids. I would also tell them that their parents are coming to lessons. It's not a test or an exam, so they don't feel anxious before coming to see me. Too much pressure on kids to be perfect these days, says Aoife in Donegal.
I think Aoife's right. And I think, you know, while that might relate to fiddle playing, there's some life lessons in that in general.
I started a job recently and they have this thing that there are no mistakes, just learning opportunities. I thought it was very unusual, very American mumbo jumbo, but it actually works with staying positive. I now have my kids doing this. Mm-hmm. So yeah, just learning opportunities.
Learning opportunities is a nice positive reframing.
This is a strange one for you. I have a nearly 13-month-old. He is not pointing or raising up his hands to be lifted. Does make eye contact at times and comes to me when he sees me after work. He doesn't clap his hands either. I am driving myself crazy Googling and the results are scaring me. He's the youngest of three. Should I be going to the GP at this stage? I'm very worried.
Look, I think I'm not even going to get into the developmental piece here, because for me, you're driving yourself crazy Googling. No good comes from Googling anything, as we all know, and yet we all do it. Absolutely, everyone does it. And you say here you're very worried. That alone for me means, yes, go to your GP, if only to get reassured. Because if you're sitting with this worry, you're going to be overlooking, overanalyzing, over-focusing on what he's not doing, and you're going to inadvertently missing all the things he is doing. So I think, you know, is he making sounds? Is he touching your face when you pick him up into close proximity? Is there that kind of interaction and touch-based connection and engagement? I want you to go to your GP or your public health nurse. I think at 13 months, it would be appropriate to call the public health nurse. If I'm right, it's around this age that the general medical officer in the area is going to be doing a developmental assessment anyway. So it would be no harm to reach out and maybe speed up that appointment. Again, I'm not trying to worry you. I'm only saying you're already worried. Use this as a point of ruling out anything worrying, reassuring yourself. And you know what, if there is something that people are concerned about, professionals are concerned about, at least you'll be getting in really quickly to have it looked at.
It can't do any harm, really, can it?
Absolutely not. But Googling will. Googling will.
It's only going to worry and keep you awake nights. Go to your doctor. Now that my 12-year-old daughter has told me she has started dieting. She has been eating her dinner, but she only has a tiny plateful. She told me she doesn't want snacks anymore and she has started a new running and jogging routine. She runs or walks a couple of times a week, although she is not doing anything particularly dangerous. I am worried that's becoming an obsession for her. I will say she is quite slim as it is. I would appreciate some advice.
Oh, I mean, the word dieting is the bit that jars with me here, that a 12-year-old is using that language. So I'm going to ask, you know, just to be cognizant, what is the language around dieting and food in your house? You know, if children tend to take, especially girls, take their leads from what is the language? Are you if you're in a slimming club of some kind, you know, they have particular language around food, be it points, units, sins. This kind of language can become very common in home. And what you're doing inadvertently is placing an emotional charge around food that you're not, children are growing up not seeing food as food, but as units or points or numbers or sins on a plate. So, and that language can be really emotionally charged and unhelpful. So, have a think yourself about what is the language at home. It may not be. You may never mention anything about weight loss, but just be aware of that. I suppose I'm also wondering, from your daughter's point of view, what is her motivation? Is it that she wishes to get fitter, be healthy, or is it that she wishes to lose weight? Because those will be different things entirely. Because, for example, Tom, like if she's on a team or a dance squad, staying fit and healthy is going to be part of her activity, and that may be driving her. But if this is about, I want to lose weight and be slim, then yes, I would respond to it. I'd reframe to her that being healthy is really good and that you're the grown up in charge and you will always make sure that there is healthy food on her plate and a healthy amount of food, so she doesn't need to worry about portions. You will do that, and that whatever you put in the plate is the right amount of food for her, so long as she's hungry for it.
Okay.
I think that can be helpful. I think if she is going out and running and jogging and doing these kinds of routines, can you go with her? Can you run and walk with her and use that time as one-to-one time to chat, talk? Because by doing that, you can also set the pace and set the length of that run and the frequency. And again, you're positively reframing it. I think you need to sit down and explain to her that everyone, especially at her age, needs 3 healthy sized meals and 2 snacks a day. But I think I would like to involve her in food prep so that she doesn't associate snacking with junk food, but you can involve her in making healthy snacks so that she's comfortable eating them. if all of this, if you're listening and going, yeah, did all of that, I'm definitely not talking about dieting or food at home, then I wouldn't rule out consulting with a qualified registered dietitian who can talk in that very third party neutral way to your daughter about food and reassure, because sometimes our children will roll their eyes at us and go, what do you know about it?
Yeah, okay.
But if you go, look, let's talk to someone who does know about it, it might be a helpful thing to do as well.
Okay, they're exposed to that kind of conversation all the time.
It's unavoidable. There is an entire advertising industry out there worth billions that are putting these subtle subliminal messages into our children from the youngest possible age. So it's not just at home. They are surrounded by it. And it's so hard to make sure that our parental voice and message is the one they default to, because we're competing with this huge industry. So I think just sit down with her and talk health rather than weight.
Next one for you is, I have a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old. We take them out of bed and bring them for a bathroom break at around 11:30 p.m. But every second night, one or other of them, or even both, will still wet the bed. What can we do?
So unusual to have two children at once that you're dealing with this in. So I think wetting the bed is surprisingly more common than people think. And it's generally works its way out. I mean, the statistics can change, you know, country to country, but broadly speaking, between the age of 5 and 10 years old, approximately 15% of children will wet the bed. And that drops to like 5% after the age of 10. So what we're seeing is that it generally works itself out by the age of 10 in the children that it does persist
as late
in.
As 10. It can be as late as 10.
Now, it can be coming from a number of reasons. You could have delayed bladder maturation, you know, that the bladder and the brain have to communicate at night in order for you to stay dry and hold it till the morning. And it may be that there's a delay in the maturation, and once the brain and body catch up, it'll go into sync. You can have that low levels of antidiuretic hormone, which is the hormone that tells the kidneys to produce less urine at night because you won't be going to the toilet. So it can be hormonal. And it can simply be that your children are incredibly deep sleepers who simply aren't waking up. I'd also ask if either parent has been a bedwetter in childhood, because that can also be a contributing factor if there was somebody in the family who did it, that maybe it runs in your family.
It runs in the family, really.
It can do. So with these two children, have they ever achieved nocturnal dryness? Have you seen a GP? If you haven't, I would certainly go to a GP to rule out anything like a UTI or any kind of medical reason. Also be aware, could they be constipated? Because that can put added pressure on the bladder as well. So there's a couple of things like that. Encourage them to pee when they get ready for bed, but again, before lights out, even if it's only 10 minutes later, get them back up and go to the toilet. Have them go to the toilet, think they're finished, and re-go again to make sure that when they stand up, sit down, or whatever it is, that they're fully emptying the bladder, and no restrict fluids after 6 p.m. I think those are practical
things to do.
And
finally for you, I'm curious what your views are on an age for talking about periods with your kids. My 6-year-old daughter pulled out a sanitary pad from my bag last week in the shop, held it up and asked, what's this for, mummy? I quickly put it away and said, that's for mammy to use. I'll tell you about that later. I'm wondering whether to bring it up again with her and give her an age-appropriate explanation about menstruation, or do I wait for another opportunity to arise? I worry that my embarrassment at being held up in the shop may have scared her off asking again. I see it as a great opportunity to foster an open relationship where she can talk about any of these things. I was always too mortified discussing with my mother. And would you suggest the same approach for boys of a 4-year-old boy?
Yeah, I think it's never too early to start these conversations. And my philosophy is generally be open, honest, and developmentally appropriate. But as soon as a child is asking a question, they're ready for some kind of an answer. And I think the fact that you said, I'll tell you about it later, you really do need to go back and say, about that question you asked me, because I think you're right. You were probably caught in the hop in the moment and were like, oh my God, put that back in the bag. But I think you want to normalize it. So I'd say it's a good idea to start this conversation early and absolutely teach boys about it too. And in the same way and the same language as you would with girls, honest but simple. Refrain from using ambiguous language, like don't say things like anti-flow, or I'm sure your texters will have a myriad of language that was used as they were growing up.
Sensational stuff.
Just
very
say
inventive
period
use of
menstruation,
language.
Just call it what it is, and, you know, break the taboo around that language. I think, you know, you can say something, you know, some variation on this depending on age, but every month, you know, there's a part of a woman's body called a uterus, and every month a layer builds up inside it, and that layer is of soft skin with a little bit of blood, and that's to help a baby grow if you choose to have a baby in there. But if there's no baby, then the uterus lets go of that layer and it comes out of your body, and there's a little bit of bleeding, and what you saw come out of my bag is used to catch the blood. It doesn't hurt and there's nothing wrong, and that's it, you move on, something like that.
That is so different to the explanations we got many, many moons ago, is all I will say.
But I just think if you say that now, most young children will go, okay.
Yeah, they will.
And move on, and that's it, done. But
the next
time they come to you. If
they're faced with facts like that, they just do tend to go, oh, okay.
It's usually our discomfort at saying it out loud. So the other thing is develop a couple of sentences and practice them with someone at home.
Joanna, thank you very much as always.
My
for
pleasure.
That. More questions please to 53106. You can listen back to the parenting podcast on newstalk.com. After the break, we'll be talking about the murder of Jean McConville.
Moncrief on Newstalk.
Sponsored by Avant Card. With personalised pricing, our rates are made for you.